Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 6, delivered on September 13, 2010. The title of this lecture is Accounting in Finance.
Today, finance in accounting. Accounting as a large field is its own discipline, and you can get a major in that, or you can come to the dark side and join us in finance, where you will have considerably more fun. But first things first, we do have to recognize that there are elements of accounting that are quite important to us. Now, in the lecture last week on the review of accounting, I just gave you a kind of a summary. Well, here is your income statement, balance sheet, retained earnings, all that kind of stuff. Here's where I put more of what we care about in finance on accounting. This is where we focus on the parts of accounting that inform us. You see, accounting is the results of accounting are information products, and we are one of the consumers of those information products that accountants produce. We are consumers of information products produced by other departments within a corporation or within the government. We are the ones who take those information products and we distill from the information knowledge. And from that knowledge, we communicate out to other users who then are to develop understanding. And ultimately, over a period of time, with a body of understanding, we hope to have our end users achieve wisdom. We cannot do the wisdom. We can't really do the understanding part. That's for our end users that we provide our products to. What we do is produce from the information knowledge. And so the information that comes to us from the accounting profession is one of the products that we use to create our knowledge. Now, first of all, we know that accountants have their own rituals. Every discipline has its own rituals, its own routines, its own terminology. In a few cases, you'll hear me use terms that are somewhat different from what you would have heard in accounting, and that's going to be that's just the way it is. But the big thing in finance is not net income or revenues or expenses or anything in between. What we care about in finance is cash flow. Because if you don't have the cash to pay your bills, your debt holders shut you down. They have the prior claim on the assets. If you do not satisfy them, then they will take you to court and they will take your assets from you. The owners, the equity holders, have the residual claim on the assets of the corporation, the residual claim. Only after the liabilities have been satisfied in a timely manner, according to the covenants of the contracts we have with those debt holders, can we then respond to the shareholders of the corporation. That's all there is to it. And unfortunately, the shareholders don't seem to understand that sometimes. I speak as a consultant when I'd have shareholders. When things got bad, the executives of several corporations would hand the problems off to me of dealing with shareholders. I don't know where my dividend check is. Well, you don't get one because we don't have enough to give you a dividend. Well, I don't understand that at all. Lady, if we don't pay our bills, you don't get a dividend check ever. We're out of business. Well, you're getting a salary, aren't you? There, you're the president of the corporation. Although that's right, he's an executive. He is a claimant on the cash flows before you are. We have a contract with him. We have a debt to him, his salary. And so it is with our electric bills and all that. they get paid, and then if there is residual, you get paid a dividend. But that's entirely at our discretion. Now, I want to emphasize that to you, that at the end of the day, you could see net income being positive, but the shareholders say, well, where's our dividend? You don't get one. Because net income is not cash in hand. Cash is cash. It's quite easy to tell. Cash is very, as a matter of fact, cash is really obvious. It looks like this. Okay? It doesn't look like accounting paper. It doesn't look like a net income line. It's cash. It might be in a bank. It might be an electronic number. It might be on a debit card, whatever. It's not income. So when we look at financial statements, we want to know how cash flow, not just what the cash flow is, but how the cash flow is affected by what the accountants write. For example, net income includes something right off the bat that's very obvious, and I mentioned this last time, depreciation. Depreciation is not a cash flow item. It doesn't exist in the real world. You don't write a check to depreciation. There is no company out there that sends you a bill. Hi, we're depreciation. Please pay your bill to us. Please write us a check. It isn't there. So the first thing we have to do is say, what impact did that have on the net income? So what impact does it have on cash flow? Now, one of the gentlemen and a couple of others said, it doesn't, though. It really doesn't. You're right as rain. It doesn't in reality, but with respect to the accounting statements, depreciation is a positive cash flow item because it elevates the cash flow above what net income says. Oh, yeah, if you, oh, goddamn, I better write that down on my quiz. Yes. It impacts, a few of you, oh, I better put that plus down there. Yes. Relative to the accounting statement, that depreciation elevates cash flow. Because if I saw that the depreciation was $20,000, net income was $130,000, I now know that the cash flow is actually $150,000. From that one item. There would be obviously be other things too, okay, which we'll talk about here as time goes on. But when I see the accounting recognize a depreciation expense, I know that the cash flow relative to the net income, Denny's this morning. No, I'm serious, noobs. See if Jack will help. I don't know what that was about. I get worked up when I start talking about cash flow. It's an old thing with me. Okay, where the hell was I? Relative to the accounting statement, I want you to remember that whenever we talk about changes in cash flow, we're looking at relative to what the accounting statement represented. Now, suppose that the accounts payable of a corporation went down. The accounts payable, I saw from December 31, 2008 to December 31, 2009, the accounts payable fell on the balance sheets. Well, okay, what would that mean in real terms? What does that mean in real terms if our accounts payable goes down? Talk to me. What would it mean? Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Some of us were not born to be accountants. God knows I was, and I've just done this long enough. I know the answers. Does anyone know?
We paid somebody.
Say it.
We paid somebody.
Our accounts payable went down, so we paid somebody. Now, when you pay somebody, is that money out of your pocket or money into your pocket?
Out.
So what impact will that have on cash flow if accounts payable goes down?
Negative.
That's excellent. That's excellent. You could be an accountant. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, now let's try something. Okay, we built a new factory. Fixed assets jumped. Our hard assets, fixed assets, went up. Talk to me. What does that do? What impact would that have on cash flow? If I saw the fixed assets increase, and notice how I'm not doing this according to some formula, remember this table. I want you to do it with just the instinct of what's happening, logically. I see my fixed assets jump. Okay, we built something big. Okay, what does that mean to cash flow? You just built something big. Your fixed assets went up.
Decreased.
Why? It decreased. Why? Why? Be more specific. Say it in real terms. You're looking at me, well, damn it to hell, I've told you. No. What happened? We spent money to build a building. We spent money. That's money out of our pocket. When we build something, when we buy something, it's going to cost us money. Now, the accountants are not allowed to recognize the entire blast of expense, the money out all at once. That's why there is depreciation, is to parcel it out through time. But in terms of the reality of what happened, we just had a whole bunch of money come out of our pocket. Okay, well, where did that money come from? Well, maybe we sold stock. If we sold stock, do we lose money or does money come into the company if we sell stock? Yeah, it comes in, yeah. And if we used, issued a bond, would that be money that goes out or comes in? It kind of comes in. So, again, you see that in reality, there is a version of that matching principle that is so important in finance. It's there. It's just that in our work, we have to rearrange what the accountants have said in their matching concept to the reality of the cash flow impact. So, okay, fixed assets went up. So that was money out. Okay, well, we raised that money by selling stock. Okay, that was money that came in. We have to adjust each item, and that's why I do that second part on the last page of that quiz, just to have you do it by gut instinct. Think about what it is that is actually happening in reality. In most cases, you can even relate it to personal experience. Okay, one of you said it exactly right. Yeah, I paid a bill. Okay, so you pay a bill, that's money out of your pocket if your accounts payable goes down. Your accounts receivable goes down. If your accounts receivable went down, well, geez, that means that, what would that mean? That means that the people who owe you don't owe you anymore. Well, why wouldn't they owe you anymore? Say it. Yes. So that means money comes in? Yes. Exactly. It's more of a, just think of it logically. Try not to memorize tables, assets go up, cash flow is negative, impact and all that, which is more the way it's done in a traditional accounting course. In finance, we want to be a little more fluid. We want to feel the force. Consider this your Jedi training or not. Okay. Probably not. Last thing I want to do is be compared to Yoda. Short, green, and ugly. Okay, now, let me take you a little bit on a journey that I was going to begin last week, and I thought, no, I want to do this now. Now, one thing that I will tell you is that when I talk about taxes, in a lot of situations, I'll just say, take 40% or 30% of net income. Or, I'm sorry, of earnings before taxes. And then that'll be your tax bill. Well, of course, that's not how it really works. And let me take you on a bit. The reason I'm doing this, I'm going to take you a little wider than the exact situation on the ground now. Because our tax system is in flux. Right now, there are challenges to very old ways of taxing, and I would almost bet that within the next 5 years, when you are actually practicing business people, we will begin to see some real serious talk about changing our tax system in fundamental ways. But right now, it's still just talk. But I want to sharpen the talk so that you know exactly what's what in the world of taxes. First things first, that in terms of how income could be taxed, business or individual, personal, there are four ways that we can, four different types of taxes. There is the flat tax, a true, genuine flat tax. There is then a proportional tax. And all oftentimes in the news media, the term flat is used when they're really talking about a proportional tax. And it just frosts the fringe on my boxers because they don't understand. There is a fundamental difference between a flat tax, a real flat tax, and a proportional tax. We'll get to that in a minute. And then there is our system, which is a progressive tax. We have a progressive tax structure. And then there is the fourth, a regressive tax structure. Now, a flat tax would be a dollar amount, just a dollar amount, an absolute amount. Everyone would pay. $50, that's your flat tax. Now, interestingly enough, a true flat tax is the love child of right-wing, a certain branch of right-wing economists, because if you get into some really high-powered economics at the uber-grad level, you'll see that that one is the only one that would actually create the least distortion on the flow of capital. But you say, well, flat taxes, everyone would pay the same amount. Let's say as a personal income tax, everyone would pay $2,000 or $10,000, whatever. And obviously, those are not around, but they are. They're all over the place, flat taxes are. Your license plates are flat tax. Hunting licenses, fishing licenses, virtually any tax where you pay just an amount of money, regardless of income, then it's a flat tax, and they're all over the place. Notice that flat taxes are highly regressive on income because a rich person pays the same amount that a poor person pays, so as a percent of income, a flat tax differentially impacts the poor. That's one of the grave injustices of flat taxes, which are very popular at state and especially at state level. That they are powerfully regressive on the poor. But they're all over the place, flat taxes are. Now, a proportional tax, and there are variations on the proportional tax. Here in the United States, the most commonly experienced kind of proportional tax is a sales tax. The most common is a sales tax, just a percent, a percentage. Okay? Now, those would sound, and that is the one that actually, when they talk about bringing the American tax system to a flat tax, what they're actually saying is a proportional tax, like a national sales tax. Unfortunately, those, like a flat tax, are actually regressive on income. They're actually regressive on income. If you have a proportional tax on sales, it is regressive on income. And how would that be? Why would that be? Well, everyone's paying the same percentage. But think about it this way. I'm going to tell you a secret. I know. I see someone right here. Perfect candidate. You, sir, someday you're going to work at State Barn. You are going to make lots of money at State Barn. And you know what I found out, and I've been with very rich people, and people who think they're rich, but they're not. They come to believe that their farts don't stink. Why? Because they have their noses so high in the air that they're absolutely convinced that the air is fresh below them as it is above them. Indeed, it's not, though. You see, because everyone has essentially a fundamental set of needs. Everything above those needs is want. I'm sure most of you have been exposed to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, at the bottom level of the hierarchy of needs in Maslow's system, we would have this base of just absolute needs, which would be, as Maslow would have described it, food and sex. Now, by that, I don't mean pizza and ass. I mean nourishment and ass, I don't know. Whatever, you know. God, it's hot in this room. Now, interestingly, by the way, if you were to take an economics course for me, I point in my lectures on communism and the theory of communist economics, Marx put into here that there is a third fundamental need. It is work. And you say, work? Now, well, that is. And he said, yes, it is. And if you think about it, even when you are not working, you are doing something that is work, gaming, leisure. You have to keep busy. So Marx would say there's a third one here, work, but we'll dispense with that. And then above that, you have shelter and safety. And once you fulfill the food and sex, then you work for shelter and safety. As I say, dinner and a butt, and then a place to sleep and a lock on the door. Okay? And then above that, group affiliation, and then a place in the group, and up to self-actualization. You are, unless we're really, really messed up, we're all on the road to self-actualization. But here's the thing. Rich or poor, we all have the same essential core needs here at the bottom. A rich person needs no better food than a poor person. A rich person needs no more sex than a poor person, notwithstanding Tiger Woods. The point there being that if I were to look at two people, a person of modest means, who makes, let's say, $30,000 a year, and a person of good means who makes $100,000 a year, they would both have the same amount of money. Regardless of what the wealthy person said, they would have a certain amount of money that would be absolutely necessary to spend on, let's say, food. Anything above that is discretion. Now, let's say that that necessary food for both of them, and anyone who would argue that the rich person needs more expensive food, that's wrong. Let's say that it's $10,000 a year for both of them. Now, let's take the tax. Let's say that we do a national sales tax of 10%. So for the poor person, that tax is going to end up being, on that, $1,000. And for this person, too, at 10%, it's going to be $1,000. No question about it, they'll all both pay for their core need the same amount of money in taxes. Now let's look at that as a percentage of income. Now let's look at that as a percentage of income. $1,000 on $30,000 versus $1,000 on $100,000 of income. And you'll notice something interesting here. Whereas the rich person pays a 1% of income tax for core needs, the poor person pays a 3.33% income tax for core needs. A proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income. It is. And you could say, well, I know that they would not tax very much basic items like milk and bread, but they would still tax them. And the tax that would be paid by the rich and the poor would be the same. Therefore, the same phenomenon would apply completely. A proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income, period. That's all there is to it. And it's even worse than that because you get into elasticities of demand. You get price elasticity, income elasticity of demand. The effect gets even worse. But anyway, now let's go to a progressive tax. That's our tax. As your tiers of income go up, you pay a higher percentage on the blocks that are higher than on the blocks that are lower. Now, our progressive tax structure has simplified enormously over the years. In the 1930s, first of all, the number of tiers was staggering compared to what it is now. I'm going to put up an article I wrote a couple of years ago describing how few tiers there are. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.